Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're bringing you an episode from The Vault. This one originally published on June 28th, 2022. It's called The Lesser of Two Crab Claws, Part 1. So part 1 in a series, I think not just about crab claws, but we were focusing generally on asymmetry in the natural world.
That's right. But if you got to pick someone to be the spokes organism or organisms for this, it, clearly it's the crabs.
Good old fiddlers, right?
Yeah.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And for the next few episodes, we're going to be doing a series on asymmetry. And to introduce this series, I wanted to talk a little bit about a favorite animal of ours, the narwhal.
Yes, the what is it? The corpse whale of the ocean, the unicorn of the sea.
Right, yeah. So corpse whale, that's literally what its name means, whale. Of course, wall, but nar meaning corpse. So yeah, it's like a dead body whale, having to do with its gray and mottled appearance as it sort of floats around near the top of the water. But the more famous feature of this whale, apart from looking like a corpse, is its horn or tusk, or we can dispute what's the best word to use for it here. But yeah, as you say, it is the unicorn of the polar seas. So the narwhal is a medium-sized Arctic marine mammal in the suborder of toothed whales, or Odontoceti. And it is immediately recognizable because most males of the narwhals, and occasionally some females as well, possess a giant spike or tusk growing straight out of their faces. And this tusk can grow absurdly long, up to about 3 meters or 10 feet. And the orientation of this tusk looks very unusual compared to most other mammals. So you think about other mammals with horns or tusks. You might think about bovines, in which the horns rise up off the top of the head, or you might think about the rhinoceros, where it points up from the end of the snout, so kind of, you know, up from the ground. Or you might think about the tusks of a boar or an elephant kind of coming out of the mouth at an angle. But no, in the narwhal, you have a whale's body, which again is a sort of mottled gray tube that can grow about 4 to 5 meters long in adulthood. And then the tusk just juts straight out of the face, adding another 3 meters or so, or up to another 3 meters or so in length. So when the tusk is present, the animal is sort of shaped like a dart or like a spear. Now, when we've talked about narwhals before, I think especially in our episodes on the unicorn legend, we talked a lot about the theories behind the origin and the purpose of the tusk. We're not going to completely rehash that discussion here, though I did want to note a development which was in a more recent paper I came across addressing the biological function of the tusk. So a long-running question for marine biologists who study the narwhal is, why this giant tusk? It looks very unwieldy. What is it for? What is the evolutionary justification? And this can be difficult to study because it is not a trivial task to go out and just observe narwhals in the wild. Not only do they live underwater, but they live under the Arctic ice, so they remain veiled in a great deal of mystery. But we're not without some clues. And I guess the place to start is that the tusk looks so threatening to the naive human brain that we immediately want to say it is a weapon, right? You know, it is a spear, it is a dart. That's what I, without even thinking about it, compared the animal to.
Right. You think of it being some sort of a javelin or spear, a harpoon on the front of this whale that it's using to skewer things, or that it's using this to sort of fence with other whales.
Yeah, so you think it must be for, you know, stabbing sharks or skewering fish prey or something. Though it's funny that people think, oh yeah, it's for skewering fish that they're going to eat. But if that were true, wouldn't that be a little awkward? Like, how would it get the fish to its mouth after that?
Yeah.
Like, you would think, normally you don't need a stab and then eat. If you're a whale, you just eat. You just bite and then swallow. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there have been some accounts of what appear to be various offensive uses of the tusk, but these might be coincidental or secondary behaviors. And then there are all other odd proposals, including things like stabbing through surface ice to create holes for breathing. Of course, remember the narwhal is an air-breathing mammal. But the fact that the tusk is hollow and filled with sensitive nerve endings has led some researchers to believe it is a sensory organ, and there is some evidence that it can be used for gathering and even potentially for sharing information about the characteristics of seawater, maybe things like temperature, salinity, and so forth. However, one of the most important clues about the primary evolutionary justification of the tusk is the fact of sexual dimorphism. So the tusks are almost always found in males. And one obvious conclusion from this is that the tusk can't be necessary for survival, or else females would have them as well, right? So it can't provide a major individual survival advantage, or else you'd expect all individuals to have them. Or we would at least observe, the whales that have them out competing the other one, the ones that don't have them in survival, which is not the case. So one of the leading theories then is that it's a sexually selected trait. It's a body feature without a major role in survival, which grows very prominent in males because it increases reproductive success, maybe by being more appealing to female narwhals, or maybe by causing rival males to stay away and so forth. And anyway, so the recent paper I found was one by Graham et al. Published in Biology Letters called "The Longer the Better, Evidence that Narwhal Tusks Are Sexually Selected." This was from 2020. And of course, this paper acknowledges that it's really difficult to study narwhals in the wild to figure out what the tusk is for. So instead, it asks if we can infer anything about tusk function from examining the natural variation in narwhal tusk measurements that have been taken over the course of the last 35 years. And so their sample comprised 245 individual adult males. And based on these measurements, the authors conclude that the evidence does suggest the primary driver of tusk evolution is sexual selection. Quote, "By combining our results on tusk scaling with known material properties of the tusk, we suggest that the narwhal tusk is a sexually selected signal that is used during male-male contests." So how would you conclude this? Well, the tusk demonstrates a growth pattern known as hyperallometry, which means a body feature that grows faster than the body as a whole. So, for example, most body features are roughly allometric. They're linearly allometric. So they grow in size proportional to the rest of the body. If your body is bigger overall, you probably also have longer shin bones and larger hands and so forth. Some features might be hypoallometric, or, you know, suballometric. They grow less than the body as a whole. But narwhal tusks are hyperallometric. In the largest individuals, the tusks grow longer than simple linear scaling would predict. So they're not just big in proportion to the rest of the body. They're way bigger than that. They get ridiculously huge. And so this is not proof, but it is characteristic of traits that are sexually selected. And the authors write in their conclusion, quote, "Sexually selected signals used in male-male competition are more likely to exhibit hyperallometry when compared to other sexually selected traits because the information being signaled is simple. I am bigger than you. To convey this message, males exaggerate the size of their signals, which facilitate the detection of size discrepancies between individuals, reducing the likelihood of engaging in potentially dangerous fights." And they note that this could explain the so-called tusking behavior that's been observed, where male narwhals sometimes appear to be crossing tusks or almost like dueling with their tusks, which could actually be not a form of fighting, but a way for the animals to compare the size of their tusks in order to avoid a fight. So in an interesting twist, it could be the case that our naive intuition that this tusk is a weapon is true in a sense, but it's a weapon designed specifically to look scary because it will discourage actual fighting between males in sexual competition most of the time. So it's, you know, two rival males are competing for a chance to mate, and one of them goes, wow, that other one's tusk is absurdly long. No need to fight this out. My mistake. See you later. Now, they say that the existing evidence sort of points us in this direction, but it's not conclusive. There are alternate explanations. Maybe the large tusk plays a role in mate choice itself. Maybe females prefer males with larger tusks. But there, in general, there's still just a lot we don't know about these animals. So the book is not completely closed on this question. And it's also possible that the tusk has multiple secondary functions, for example, as a sensory organ, like we talked about earlier. Though, again, as I mentioned earlier, those secondary functions can't be all that crucial for survival, or we would see that, you know, we would see that playing out in narwhal populations. The ones with the tusks would be more likely to survive, and that's not what we find. Now, to bring it back to the reason I wanted to talk about narwhals in today's episode, you may remember one strange fact about the narwhal's tusk from our previous episodes where these animals came up, and it's that the narwhal's tusk is not an external keratinous horn like that of the rhinoceros. Instead, it is a tooth. And I don't just mean it is made out of the same stuff as a tooth. It is literally a tooth. It is a tooth from the upper jaw that has been repurposed by evolution to grow into a tusk by changing the orientation of growth so that it grows straight out forward out of the jaw, and then erupts from the flesh of the face. It literally grows through the flesh of the upper lip and then continues growing rapidly, and as we've seen, even hyperallometrically. But here's what I've been getting hung up on. The narwhal's tusk is not only a tooth, in almost all cases, it is the left canine, the left maxillary canine tooth, having erupted from the upper lip.
And this is certainly something when you learn it for the first time, it does feel a little bit wrong. I mean, a number of these factoids about the narwhal perhaps feel a little wrong, you know, because ultimately it's just a far weirder and perhaps sillier animal than most of us assumed.
It is not silly. It is deadly serious. But it does have one tooth just poking out of its lip for, I don't know, 10 feet. But you're not allowed to laugh. So to quote from a paper from 2012 in the Anatomical Record by Nuiya et al., quote, "Males usually exhibit an erupted tusk on the left side and an unerupted embedded tusk on the right." So it's got two of these teeth. It's got, you know, that's symmetrical. There's one on each side, except usually one just kind of grows a little bit and then stays inside the upper jaw and doesn't do anything, while the other one breaks through the skin and grows up to 10 feet long. So that's what you usually see. But then the quote continues, whereas females usually have two embedded tusks, neither erupting, other less common expressions of narwhal dentition include males with two tusks, males with two embedded tusks, so neither one comes out, females with one erupted and one embedded tusk, and females with two erupted tusks. And I checked, I think there's only been one documented case of the latter, of the females with two tusks coming out. But the authors of this paper do extensive analysis to confirm that these are not horns, they are teeth. And they figure out exactly what teeth they are. They are the upper canines, and in almost all cases, the left upper canine. Now, I don't know if I'm alone in this, but I am just as struck by the fact that the tusk is actually the left canine as I am about the fact that it's a tooth to begin with. Why the left canine? As the paper mentions, narwhals occasionally have two erupted tusks, two tusks of about the same length coming out together. It's rare, but you find some like that. And if you see pictures of the narwhals with two tusks, they look much more appropriate to the preferences of nature. You can look up images of this online. In fact, even though they're much more rare in the wild, a lot of the images of narwhal skulls have two tusks, I guess because the rare ones get photographed more often.
Well, I mean, I guess on one hand, the left-handed side is the sinister side, the sinestral side. So if you're going to have a crazy super long tooth emerge from your face, maybe the sinister side makes sense.
Well, that's just your twisted mind working its fancy. I mean, no, come on. The two tusks, they look more like something that you would just by intuition expect to find in the ocean, much more so than the common one-tusked skull, which when I see it, I mean, it is beautiful, but it also looks unbalanced and wrong.
Though I will say that the two-tusked narwhal, if you look up images of specimens of this creature, like this one is perplexing as well, because it doesn't form... they're not perfectly parallel to each other. It creates kind of a V shape that is a little confusing and certainly makes you lean more into possibilities. Yeah, that this is not about stabbing or using these tusks for some sort of a physical practical use, but something else. Like they look more like communications array when you see two of them as opposed to just one.
Well, yeah, I think having two of them even further highlights that these are obviously not practically useful for something like catching prey or eating. You know, you just you look at that and it's like, how's that going to work? And it's obvious they're not using it for that, at least not most of the time.
Right.
I know there are these little anecdotes of somebody saying that, they saw a narwhal like tap a fish with a tusk or something. So maybe, but that clearly does not appear to be a primary use of them. But I wanted to come back to the idea that it looks wrong, at least, even though, of course, this is what evolution selected. It is it is right for something. It has a use, but it looks wrong to our brains. And so it causes you to ask the question, well, first of all, why is it that evolution drove the narwhal to be unbalanced in this way? And second, why is it that my intuition tells me incorrectly that a long single tusk should not emerge from the socket of the left maxillary canine? Like if an animal has one tusk, it should come out of a hole right in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is going to be the beginning of a series of episodes. We're going to do at least two, maybe more. We'll see. But they will be on asymmetry in the animal world when an animal's left and right do not match. So in future episodes, we will explore some theoretical questions about embryonic development and how animal asymmetry comes about. Probably look at some crabs and other crustaceans. But today, I think we're gonna look especially at like whales and other swimming creatures of the sea. Just generally highlight some interesting examples of asymmetry in the natural world.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Now, I think it's important to acknowledge at the beginning that the kind of symmetry or asymmetry we're talking about, the kind of symmetry we expect to see in animals, is only one specific type of symmetry called bilateral symmetry, and not all animals actually possess it, even in an approximate sense. So bilateral symmetry is actually a fairly restricted type of symmetry. There are three dimensions of space, and if you plot a human body on those three dimensions, you'll notice we are actually only symmetrical along one of those three axes. So on height, our heads and our feet, of course, are not mirror images of each other. On depth, we're also not symmetrical. Our backs do not mirror our fronts. We don't have faces or butts on both sides. It's only across our width that you find approximate symmetry. Our left side roughly mirrors our right side. And in three-dimensional space, the most perfectly symmetrical form is actually a sphere, since if you divide a sphere in half along any plane you want, no matter its orientation, the two sides will match. And I hesitate because I'm about to make a generalization about geometry. I'm always afraid I'm going to say something wrong there, but I tried to look this up and confirm it. I believe this is unique to the sphere, that all other 3D shapes can be bisected in ways where the two halves may have equal volume, but will not match in outline. But if you cut a sphere in half, it's always two perfect hemispheres, no matter what direction you cut from. And this actually connects to a passage in a book I came across by the mathematician Hermann Weyl called Symmetry from Princeton University Press in 1952. And Weyl is writing about the history of association between symmetry in the geometric sense and the concept of beauty, moral virtue and perfection. And he writes, quote, "Because of their complete rotational symmetry, the circle in the plane and the sphere in space were considered by the Pythagoreans the most perfect geometric figures. And Aristotle ascribed spherical shape to the celestial bodies because any other would detract from their heavenly perfection." Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, knowing what we know now about the cause of spherical objects in space, namely gravity, right? That as the mass of an object increases, it tends to become more and more perfectly spherical, with the, I guess, the end point of that being that a black hole, theoretically, is pretty much perfectly spherical. Whereas smaller objects in space, because gravity is not as strong a force on the smoothing of their outer edges, they can have more irregular shapes. This is why you get irregular potato-shaped comets and asteroids, but, you know, you start getting up into planet size and you move closer and closer to spherical perfection. But anyway, Weil goes on to quote a poet named Anna Wickham, which was actually the pseudonym of a modernist poet named Edith Alice Mary Harper, in connecting the idea of symmetry to God or the divine being. So Wickham writes, quote, "God, thou great symmetry, who put abiding lust in me, from whence my sorrows spring, for all my frittered days that I have spent in shapeless ways, give me one perfect thing." And then Weil writes, "Symmetry, as wide or as narrow as you may define its meaning, is one idea by which man through the ages has tried to comprehend and create order, beauty, and perfection." And equating symmetry with beauty, goodness, and perfection, and even divinity, can be found all throughout literature. I think of Blake's The Tiger, you know, "What immortal hand or eye could mm-hmm. frame thy fearful symmetry?" I guess it makes you want to say symmetry there. But this clearly has not just a geometric meaning where, you know, well, the two halves of the tiger do match one another roughly because it is an animal with bilateral symmetry, but that it means something more than that. Symmetry here is in some sense synonymous with greatness or divinity.
Yeah, it's the tiger is a perfect organism in Blake's eye here. A lot can be said about our obsession with symmetry, to the point to where it's like a flawed obsession with it. Like, we think mm-hmm. that we want, say, perfectly symmetrical faces when most faces are certainly not symmetrical. And if you take even famous and, often held up as beautiful faces, and you do the trick of creating a symmetrical face out of it, it's going to look wrong to your eyes. It may look very well look unnatural.
Well, the whole quest for symmetry in aesthetic beauty is one of those where it's like, there's almost a kind of inverse uncanny valley. It seems like people's natural preferences are something that tends very close to symmetry. But then if you get right up to it and go to actual symmetry, it's like, oh, no, that looks all wrong.
Yeah.
So you want to be like right in the zone where you're approaching symmetry, but not there.
Yeah, though certainly when you get into design, it gets weird, because take airplanes, for example. Mm-hmm. Airplanes tend to look best to our eye when they are perfectly symmetrical. And mm-hmm. there are various reasons for that. And if you see an asymmetrical airplane, and there have been certainly been some very asymmetrical looking airplane designs here and there throughout aviation history, they do look incredibly wrong to the eye. And they shouldn't fly. Yeah. Like how was that a good idea? But it can work. It's just you generally don't see it.
Well, there's a different logic at work here, but that just sort of reminds me incidentally of how I'm always surprised at the idea that a plane can continue to fly with one engine, you know, as like mm-hmm. two jet engines, like one engine fails, but it can keep flying with the other one, which that doesn't seem right. It seems like, well, if only one engine is going, then shouldn't it just sort of like spin out of control? But no, I mean, as long as it's generating forward thrust, it can keep going usually.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's always a strong argument, you know, that much of what we find beautiful and good is biologically contingent, that it has at least in part to do with the kind of animals we are and how we relate to our environment. And of course, we are part of that clade of animals known as bilateria. These are the animals featuring bilateral symmetry during embryonic development. Now, of course, this is always approximate, right? Because while your left and your right, in one sense, do match, they are mirror images of each other, as you were just talking about, they're not perfect mirror images of each other, and especially on the inside, because we have, say, asymmetric distribution of our internal organs, like the heart's more to one side, the liver's more to the other, and so forth. But for it, for approximate terms, at least externally, our left and our right sides match, but not all animals exhibit bilateral symmetry. Some have radial symmetry, meaning they grow in like repeated structures in a more spiral pattern. And there are some, like sponges, for example, those are animals, but they have no symmetry at all. But most animals, like humans, are bilaterally symmetrical. As our bodies grow during embryonic development, they grow into basically mirrored halves on the left and right. But as we've already seen with the narwhal, some animals with bodies that mostly adhere to bilateral symmetry present with isolated but radical deviations, such as the narwhal's left maxillary canine turning into a tusk almost as long as the animal itself. And this is not even the only example of fascinating asymmetry in the bodies of whales.
Yeah. I want to get into something that we may have touched on this a little bit in the past, but despite the number of times that whales come up, I don't think we've really gotten into everything here. And it concerns the nature of the blowhole of whales. Again, it just drives home just how mysterious and weird whales really are. So I want to start sort of back up before we get to where we're going with this discussion of blowholes. Start with the baleen whale. You know, these are filter feeders, which, as Ryan Tucker Jones points out in Red Leviathan, this is the book about Soviet whaling, and I interviewed Ryan last week on the show. It was a really fun episode if anyone wants to go back and listen to that. But he touches on just sort of how intertwined folktale and legend and mythology is with our understanding of whales and misunderstanding of whales. I want to read this one passage. Quote, "Ancient Greeks knew far less about whales than did the whaling Scandinavians, and as these word origins suggest, whales remain mysterious for Russians. For one thing, baleen whales' methods of feeding perplex them. Lacking teeth, the giants seem to have no way of capturing prey. One 10th century Russian poem wondered whether whales, quote, the mother of all fish, unquote, fed themselves on, quote, heavenly fragrances. Direct experience was not necessarily more helpful. A medieval Western whaler who cut into a stranded whale's stomach and found a gray mass of food concluded that it had fed on, quote, internal fog."
That's great.
So, yes, whales are mysterious. And, yeah, you can imagine if you really didn't know what was going on with a baleen whale, you might have trouble figuring out what's going on with their with their mouths. What do they truly feed on? What is there enough of in the ocean for them to consume if they're not eating our ships and so forth? So anyway, if you look at a baleen whale and you look away from its mouth, you'll notice, yes, it has the blowholes. The blowhole falls well in line with bilateral anatomy. There are two of them in kind of a V shape. And guess what? If you weren't aware of this, here's your fun initial fact. They are repositioned nostrils.
Imagining the evolutionary journey of those nose holes.
Yes, because it is a journey. The nose holes traveling from the front of the snout all the way to the top of the head. I mean, we can imagine it. It's hard to imagine with our own face, but imagine it with a much bigger and more prolonged head.
Amazing.
So as Roston and Roth point out in a 2021 paper published in the Journal of Anatomy, the nasal passage in these whales has rotated dorsally over the course of evolution. And early in development, cetacean embryos have head morphologies that resemble other mammals. So you can actually look up embryo images and observe the nasal openings shift from the tip of the snout to the back of the head. If you want to see some easily accessed examples of this, Panda's Thumb, a science blog, has some great images of this in their post, Whale Evolution, the Blowhole. And I included these for you to look at here, Joe. If you look up this blog post, you'll see a trio of images with the embryo, and there's a little white arrow pointing out where the nostrils are and then where they travel to.
It's just as you say, yeah. So earlier in development, they're toward the front, like they would be on the snout, and more like they would have been on the whale's land walking ancestors. But yeah, then as development moves on, they move up the head, up to where I don't know if this is the right terminology, but you might call like the forehead, and then further mm-hmm. and further.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's obviously natural selection went this way, and it's easy to just sort of assume, okay, natural evolution and natural selection, and knows what it's doing. Who are we to question it? So it's easy to sort of overlook the basic question in all of this. Why? Why does the nostril, why do the nose open, the nasal openings on these creatures wander over the course of their evolutionary development until they're on the top of the head? The basic answer is that while these creatures, yes, technically could still breathe through their nostrils when they were positioned at the end of their snouts, they would have to lift their snouts out of the water to do so. And that requires more energy. If you have the nose and the nasal openings positioned higher up on the snout, well, that's less lift required to do so, less energy. And so this is why we have that gradual movement of the nasal openings. And we have fossil evidence to back this up. And there are examples of this in that panda's thumb post as well. For instance, we have fossil evidence of Rhodocetus. This is a whale from roughly 47 to 46 million years ago. And this one offers a midpoint where we see the nasal opening not at the end of the snout, like we see in really ancient whale ancestors, and also not at the top of the head, like we see with modern whales, but that midpoint in between.
Now, I'm not speaking from an expert perspective here, but it seems very significant that the blowhole eventually moves back to above where the eyes are, right? Because you can imagine mm-hmm. if a whale has to lift its eyes above the surface of the water every time it wants to breathe, or at least to point its eyes up away from where it's scanning, it's not just taking energy. I mean, of course, the energetic investment is significant. Imagine if you had to like lift your head up every time you wanted to breathe. That would get tiring after a while. But also if you basically like couldn't see what was going on around you every time you had to take a breath, because, you know, you need, if you're living under the water, you want to keep your eyes fixed below the water. That's where the relevant stuff is going on. If you have to lift your eyes above the surface of the water, you are losing sight of your surroundings.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the world that the whale has adapted to, the marine environment. And so over time, it just gets to the point where as little of the animal as possible has to breach the surface of the water.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So that's basically the symmetrical whale blowhole. But here's where it gets fun. This is where it gets asymmetrical, because not all whales have two blowholes. Not all have those two nasal openings, repurposed nasal openings on the top of their head. Toothed whales, like the sperm whale, have just one. In fact, on the sperm whale, this single blowhole is at an angle on the left side of the head, and this causes it to blow forward and slightly to the left. So this can actually make sperm whale spouts harder to spot for humans, but also makes them easier to identify if you do spot them, because it's not just blasting straight up. Again, it's blasting forward and slightly to the left.
But this is putting me back in narwhal tusk territory. So it has one nostril. So this is not just the nostrils have moved back along the center line of the skull across evolutionary time. The nostrils have actually split, and one of them has moved back here, and the other one, I don't know what, it's doing something else?
Yeah, the other one, the crazy thing is, essentially, the one is still open and active. The other one has sealed over. The other nasal passage is there. It just does not connect to the surface anymore. That doesn't mean it's not doing anything. It has another purpose. So instead of connecting to the exterior of the animal, this other nasal passage supplies air to the phonic lips. The phonic lips produce clicks that travel the length of the nose and through the spermaceti organ of the head to aid in echolocation, or at least this is the most well-accepted theory of what's going on here with the structure of the sperm whale's head.
So echolocation is using sound waves in order to be able to image underwater, to see where things are, not with vision, but by producing clicks that like hit things in the water and then come back to the sensory organs on the whale so they can navigate their environment. And specifically, I think, know where prey is in the dark waters.
Yeah. So if you're diving down to eat yourself some squid, some giant squid, maybe this is what you would use. Now, the evolutionary divergence likely occurred during the Oligocene. This would have been 33 to 23 million years ago, as toothed whales diverged from the ancestors of filter-feeding whales.
And this would totally make sense. So predatory toothed whales develop asymmetry related to their ability to echolocate because they need to use echolocation to hunt. Filter-feeding whales do not have the same hunting needs, so their skulls remain balanced on the left and right. Rob, I thought this was a really interesting find. And so I was looking to support this. I found a 2020 paper on the cranial asymmetry of whales. And this was by Ellen J. Coombs et al., published in BMC Biology in 2020. And for this paper, making use of museum collections, the researchers compared whale skulls across time, reaching back to whale ancestors that lived 50 million years ago. And the authors write, quote, "Early ancestors of living whales had little cranial asymmetry and likely were not able to echolocate. Archaeocetes display high levels of asymmetry in the rostrum, potentially related to directional hearing, which is lost in early neocetes, the taxon including the most recent common ancestor of living cetaceans. nasofacial asymmetry. So again, asymmetrical placement of the nostrils in the face becomes a significant feature of odontoceti or toothed whales in the early Oligocene, just like you said, reaching its highest levels in extant taxa. Separate evolutionary regimes are reconstructed for odontocetes living in acoustically complex environments, suggesting that these niches impose strong selective pressure on echolocation ability and thus increased cranial asymmetry. So, to summarize, the skulls of toothed whales, specifically the toothed ones, just keep getting weirder and more asymmetrical over evolutionary time. So as the millions of years march on, the heads are getting less and less symmetrical. And this is especially true, apparently, in places where echolocation is more difficult due to environmental conditions. And what could be an example of this? Well, I was looking in the paper, and this could be a coincidence, but they note that the narwhal has an unusually asymmetrical skull, apart from the tusk that juts out on one side. So to read a quote from this paper with a bit of paraphrasing, and remember the genus of the narwhal is Monodon, one tooth meaning Monodon. Monodon remains the most asymmetric skull in the sample, even when the rostrum is removed, which rules out the possibility that an asymmetric tusk and residual teeth may be skewing the overall result. Their unique sound repertoire, narrowband structured, NBS, is ideal for projecting and receiving signals in icy, shallow waters where the animals can detect targets in high levels of ambient noise and backscatter. So that's interesting. This could be a total coincidence. I would not want to suggest a causal connection. But I don't know, it stuck out to me that narwhals have both strongly asymmetrical skulls, probably to aid in echolocation in a difficult environment, and also extreme asymmetrical teeth producing these tusks, probably as a sexually selected trait.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show you just how weird whales are. Like, they're just so delightfully strange. And again, it's easy to take it for granted if you don't lean in closely enough, you know.
But as wonderful as whale bodies are, they are not the only creatures in the sea with striking and fascinating imbalances between their left and right sides.
Yeah, there are a number of fascinating examples we could turn to, and I don't know, we may come back to some more in future episodes. But one that really caught my attention is Histiotuthis, the cockeyed squid. So this is another example of essentially divided attention and divided bodies in the deep ocean. So Histiotuthis resides in the mesopelagic zone, or the twilight zone of the ocean. And you can certainly think of this as a realm situated between different kingdoms of illumination, because above this zone, above the creatures of this realm, well, there's the distant kingdom of light. Okay, there's a dim illumination coming down from the sun, from the more sunlit portions of the ocean, and so silhouettes can be viewed of creatures above you against that faint light. Below you, well, there's the great darkness of the depths. But in that great darkness, you'll glimpse, or if you're a squid, you'll glimpse sparkles and pulsations of bioluminescence here and there, and of course, both of these sightings are important because they both have to do with organisms that may be a threat, that may be food, etc.
Oh, well, this is so interesting because we know of lots of examples on the surface world, say like lots of herbivores on the surface mm-hmm. world that have one eye on each side of their head to try to provide a sort of, as wide a field of view as possible so you can see things approaching you. But this is a scenario where you might have a head structured like that, but you have totally different seeing needs on either side.
Exactly. And so that's what we see with Histiotuthis. As described by Thomas Robison and Johnson in their 2017 paper in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B, it is a creature with, quote, two eyes for two purposes. So the squid's two eyes here are dimorphic in size, shape, and sometimes lens pigmentation. I included an image for you to look at here, Joe, and you and folks listening, you can look up images of this as well. Not all images of the squid are going to really capture this, but you'll find some that do. And it's very weird when you can see both eyes at once, because one, the image I was looking at, one eye is this great big kind of swollen looking eye that has kind of a yellowish or greenish tint to it. It may appear to be glowing the way that the light is catching it. And the other eye appears smaller, flatter, almost looks like, if you didn't know what you were looking at, you might think, oh, well, this poor squid, one of its eyes is inflamed and swollen, or one of its eyes has been severely wounded and doesn't look like it's operating anymore. But no, both eyes are operating. They're just pointed in different directions, and they have evolved to see differently depending on the environments that they're gazing into.
It's beautiful. One looks like a setting gangrenous sun, and the other looks like a blueberry that's a little bit rotten.
Right. So it's thought that the larger of the two eyes is honed to spot objects silhouetted against that dim light above, while the smaller eye specializes in spotting the sources of bioluminescence in the darkness below. And the squid will actually position itself in a tail-up position in order to maximize the split vision. Furthermore, the authors share that we do seem to have yellow pigments in the larger eye that may serve to break the counter-illumination camouflage of their prey above. Counter-illumination is an active camouflage method by which lights are produced on the body to match background lights. So this would be used by a creature to blend in with the light above it so that creatures below them don't so cleanly make out their dark bodies against the dim lights above.
Oh, that's a good survival strategy. Yeah, you have lights on your underside to mimic the sunlight.
Yeah, and so the yellow pigments in this larger eye apparently helps to sort of break through some of that. So the theory is that we see dimorphic specializations in each eye as an adaptation to the split visual world. And this actually reminded me of a bit from a Dr. Seuss book, I Had Trouble in Getting to Sola Salou, where you have this character who's dealing with a bunch of threats, and it goes, "So I said to myself, now I'll just have to start to be twice as careful and be twice as smart. I'll watch out for trouble in front and back sections by aiming my eyeballs in different directions." And you have this character that's kind of like a little bear creature, and his eyes are gazing off in different directions. But essentially, like that's kind of what is going on with the cockeyed squid here.
That's great. I was trying to imagine what scenario could give rise to something like this on a land dwelling herbivore. You know, so you have like a bovine that's grazing. Would it need to have totally different types of eyes or vision on one side of the head? And I imagine, what about some kind of bovine that lives on a tidally locked world, and it lives at the Terminator line? So one eye needs to be like shielded because it's always facing toward the hot side of the planet, and the other eye needs to be very sensitive because it's always facing toward the dark side. I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess that would be the region that a life form might be likely to live in, because you would have less of an extreme of heat or cold. But of course, it would also be a chaotic region as well. You would probably have a lot of climactic weather going on there.
Yeah, tidally locked planet's probably not great for goats, but I was just trying to imagine. Come on.
But no, that's conceivably, that's the kind of environment that might require some sort of drastic change in the positioning of the eyes and the specialization of the eyes. We're so hardwired for our surface world environment. It is difficult for us. It's a little challenging to put ourselves in the mindset and ultimately the ocular world of something like a goat, or something like a purely predatory cat or something, much less to put ourselves in the mind set in the ocular world of the squid, or to get into the sense worlds of whales and so forth. It's a different environment altogether. And these environments, as we see from these examples we've looked like, they almost literally can pull us in half. You know, they can can change it. They can break whatever seeming symmetry was there in the body originally as it adapts, as it evolves to fit this environment over time.
Oh, this raises a question that comes to my mind actually quite often. When you think about, like, if there were other clades of animals that became very intelligent and had something like art, what would they find beautiful, and how would it be different from what we find beautiful based on our brains and our biology?
Yeah.
But I think maybe we're going to have to call the first episode there. We will certainly be back with more marvels of asymmetry in subsequent episodes. We're going to talk about crabs and crustaceans, and I think we'll talk about snakes some, probably come back to some fish, and maybe some larger developmental theoretical concerns about where asymmetry comes from in the kingdoms of life.
That's right. In the meantime, you can check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, which you can find wherever you get your podcast. Tuesdays and Thursdays are our core episodes. We have a short form artifact or monster fact on Wednesday, a little listener mail on Monday. And then on Friday, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a strange film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.